letter asked that future payments and other correspondence be sent to a post office box in Houston. Although the letter says Mortgage Bankers is the fifth largest mortgage banking company in the United States, law enforcement authorities say it doesn't exist. While Robert Precht, a St. Paul, Minnesota attorney who represents mortgage lenders, says the company's solicitation shouldn't fool people, it does every day. People living above the line would take the time to investigate the situation. Those living below the line will lose their shirts. The former own their circumstances, while the latter become willing victims. At the University of Southern California Business School, Richard B. Chase, professor of business administration, taught a class in the management of service operations, where he offered students a money-back guarantee of $250 if they weren't satisfied with his performance by the end of the course. That offer represented a big risk in an academic environment not known for its emphasis on accountability. Chase wanted to impress upon his students, as they studied the superior service practices of companies such as Federal Express and Domino's Pizza, that customers expect the service they pay for. While some of Chase's colleagues worried about the implications of his experiment, we admire it as a clever way of communicating accountability. Professor Chase owns his circumstances, and even though he could have ended up paying as much as $13,000 if all of his students demanded their money back, he was willing to take the risk. However, just to make sure he didn't take an inordinate amount of the responsibility for what his students learned, he required that they request rebates before they obtained their final grades. Some healthcare businesses are also trying to make sure they please their customers. In a Wall Street Journal story entitled, "Pleasing Hospital Patients Can Pay Off," the reporters found a few hospitals owning their circumstances and enhancing profits as a result. As the healthcare industry moves into an era of accountability and cost-cutting, the desire to relate patient feedback directly to the bottom line is likely to grow, say hospitals and management service companies. Take St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey, for example. All patients are asked to evaluate quality of food, cleanliness, and staff courtesy using a questionnaire that provides a measuring stick for a novel contract that links profit to patient satisfaction. Hospitals that farm out certain hospital services, including St. Barnabas, Faulkner Hospital in Boston, and Park Ridge Hospital in Rochester, New York, are in the forefront of what may be a key operating strategy for the future: share the risk. Contracts that contain incentives have been around for years, and so have patient surveys. But partnering has linked the two formally and raised the ante higher for vendors, who are sometimes expected to invest in state-of-the-art equipment for use in the hospital they have contracted with. A performance-linked contract is a vendor's gamble, concedes Ronald Del Moro, president and chief executive officer of St. Barnabas. But he adds, "If we're successful, they're successful." For St. Barnabas, owning their circumstances and getting their affiliates and suppliers to do likewise results not only in happier patients, but also in healthier profits. Unfortunately, millions of people keep themselves from achieving the results and happiness they so desperately pursue because they just can't bring themselves to see both sides of the story and own their circumstances. According to an Associated Press series of articles entitled "Are We Happier?" by Leslie Dreyfus, the number of books on the topic, happiness, has quadrupled in recent years, and the therapy industry has more than tripled in size. Excruciatingly frank talk shows dominate afternoon TV, and entire catalogs are devoted to marketing meditational tapes and inspirational videos. People pay hundreds of dollars and travel thousands of miles to retreats like Esalen, the granddaddy of human potential centers in Big Sur, California. Still, baby boomers are four times likelier to say they're not satisfied with their lives than are people of their parents' generation, according to an Associated Press poll. Experts estimate the incidence of psychological depression is 10 times what it was pre-World War II. In our increasingly complex and changing world, it seems more and more people think they exert less and less control over their happiness. Just like Dorothy and her friends in The Wizard of Oz, a lot of people take the trek to the Emerald City, where they hope that a personal audience with the wizard will solve all their problems. All too often, such people blame their lack of happiness on perplexing circumstances that seem totally beyond their control. Rather than own their circumstances by seeing the whole story, they choose to view themselves as incapable of modifying their situations through their own actions, resigning themselves to being acted upon by influences and forces rather than the other way around. It seems ironic that in this information age, millions of people feel such a lack of control over their lives. Obviously, the communications revolution has done little to overcome and may even have contributed to a feeling of detachment and disconnectedness with circumstances and other people. As a result, our world has come perilously close to becoming a society of victims in which its citizens, no matter the nation, feel paralyzed rather than empowered by what they observe and learn every day. In such a climate, it's not terribly surprising that so many people resist ownership of the consequences of their own behavior. A society of observers is not a society of participants. If you sit on the sidelines watching the game of your life play out before your eyes, you relinquish your ability to affect the final score just as much as a spectator watching a football or baseball game from the bleachers. To remedy this darkening malaise, people must abandon the bleacher seats and jump onto the playing field. You can take an important step in that direction by embracing the whole story and accepting ownership for your circumstances, no matter what the condition or history of those circumstances. Failure to do so invites dire consequences. The consequences of not owning it. After the Columbia space shuttle tragedy, space exploration supporters became even more critical of the government and NASA for putting too much emphasis on cost-cutting at the expense of safety. According to the Wall Street Journal, 9 months ago, the former chairman of NASA's Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel testified before Congress that the agency's budget constraints would eventually affect space shuttle safety. To rebut those complaints, or at least deflect them from lawmakers, the House Appropriations Committee yesterday released tables with historical NASA budget information showing that the agency's funding has closely mirrored its request to Congress. Not surprisingly, no one wants to own the full circumstances surrounding the worst shuttle disaster since the Challenger explosion over 20 years ago. NASA complains about the lack of funding. The administration complains about spending overruns, and Congress claims they only did what they were asked to do. It will take years for NASA to recover from the Columbia tragedy, and even more years for government executives and lawmakers to face the reality that safe, productive space exploration may cost more than they are willing to pay. In the wake of the disaster, three high-ranking decision-makers have been put in new assignments. Of this, a Cleveland paper, The Plain Dealer, editorializes, "What is happening in the shuttle program is about far more than putting engineers' heads on pikes. No one should lose sight of the cultural problems NASA's best-informed critics continue to lament. The problems that were fatal to Columbia and its crew of seven had a great deal more to do with administrative systems, policies, and traditions than with any three particular decision-makers." Truly owning the circumstances that you face requires you to make a link between what has happened and all the factors contributing to the problem, however much that linkage may implicate you. Then, and only then, can you effectively move to the next step. Ownership is the ability to connect current circumstances with what I have done and the ability to tie future circumstances with what I am going to do. If you can't make these connections, you'll never own it, and you won't ever solve it. We all know the old adage, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Well, ownership implies that if you are not part of the problem, you are not part of the solution. Tragically, you will always suffer the consequences of not owning the full extent of your circumstances, both present and future. Owning it requires a candid effort to acknowledge what everyone would rather sweep under the carpet before it's too late. In contrast, Bradco, the largest privately owned drywall and plaster company in California, found the heart to own its circumstances when the initial actual costs in a major project started coming in much higher than estimated. If the cost-to-budget discrepancy were allowed to continue, the company would face an enormous loss by the end of the project. Promptly, one of the estimators on the project started spending his evenings on his own time scouring the project plans and budgets to figure out what had gone wrong. No one in the company had assigned him this responsibility, and no one had blamed him for the problem. But nevertheless, he chose to own the company's problem and spent countless personal hours reviewing stacks of paper and blueprints to get to the bottom of things. To his chagrin, he not only isolated the problem, but also discovered he himself had caused it. During the estimating phase of the project, he had overlooked a single wall in the detailed plan from which he had developed his estimate. In a domino effect, that same wall was emitted from all 18 floors of the building. When the estimator informed company executives of his mistake, he knew he was putting his career on the line. But instead of receiving a pink slip, he won praise from higher-ups, who thanked him for his investigation and his willingness to bring the problem to light without regard for his own reputation. Because the accountable estimator located the problem early, Bradco could adjust to allow for completion of the project on time and within budget. In the months following the incident, the estimator's story was told and retold throughout the company as an example of what it means to own it at Bradco. Before you create an own-it culture where people buy in, sign up, and invest themselves in achieving results, you must first learn to assess and develop your own ability to own your circumstances. The Own-It Self-Assessment. As we have said, owning your circumstances depends on seeing both the victim and accountable sides of a story. You should therefore begin your assessment by identifying a current situation in which you feel victimized, taken advantage of, or otherwise find yourself languishing below the line. If you can't think of a current situation, consider a past one, choosing a story from your work, home, personal, community, social, or church life. Once you have selected your story, complete Part 1 of the Own It Self-Assessment form by listing facts that describe why you feel or felt victimized or taken advantage of. Try to list the victim facts of your story in a way that will persuade someone else that you really weren't at fault. As we discussed earlier in this chapter, most people quite naturally focus on the facts that make them feel victimized or taken advantage of while screening out the accountable facts that support their own role in creating their circumstances. Therefore, in Part 2 of the Own It Self-Assessment, you want to move beyond such filtering, focusing instead on the accountable facts of your story, that is, the other version of your story where you delineate your own actions or inactions which contributed to your circumstances. The following five key questions will help guide your assessment. 1. Can you cite the most convincing point of the other side of the story that they are telling? 2. If you wish to warn someone in similar circumstances not to make the same mistakes, what would you tell them? 3. What facts did you choose to ignore? 4. What facts should you add to the story that you have left out? And 5. What would you do differently if you faced this situation again? With the aid of these five questions, complete Part 2 of the Own It Self-Assessment by listing at least 4 accountable facts. Once you've done that, we'll show you how to score your responses. After you have listed an accountable fact, score your willingness to own it by asking yourself how accountable you feel for that fact on a scale of 1 to 10. A score of 1 means you do not feel at all accountable for a particular fact, whereas a score of 10 signifies that you feel fully accountable for that fact. Then add up your total combined score and divide that score by the number of facts that you listed. Finally, evaluate your cumulative score by using the table. While a low score suggests that you are failing to assume ownership for your situation, it may also indicate that you truly are a victim of your current circumstances. Even so, you do not want to remain in the victim cycle. A person who owns his or her circumstances never allows the actions of someone or something else to keep them stuck below the line. Instead, the accountable person accepts whatever ways in which his or her own behavior contributed to the situation and sets about overcoming those circumstances, no matter how difficult. At the same time, every day people tell compelling, legitimate stories about how they were truly victimized without any opportunity to have changed the outcome. Whether their stories detail violent crimes, natural disasters, or a slow economy with layoffs and prolonged unemployment, these people usually have fallen victim to circumstances beyond their control. However, we believe that even true victims cannot move toward happier times until they can be accountable for where they go from here. In one case, we heard about a husband and wife in Florida whose home was destroyed by a hurricane. Devastated by the loss of all their personal belongings, the couple retreated to their vacation home on the island of Kauai to recuperate and to wait out the rebuilding of their Florida home. Shortly after their arrival, another hurricane struck the Hawaiian Islands, demolishing their vacation home. Clearly, these two people had gotten battered by these natural disasters, suffering deep grief and frustration as a result. But even so, they resolved that these calamities would not destroy their lives. Instead, they acknowledged the fact that they had built their homes in areas vulnerable to such disasters, and they committed themselves to relocating and rebuilding with optimism and faith. After all, they had survived two disasters, and they had come through with their health and human abilities still intact. What a good lesson for us all! Owning our circumstances gives us the strength to overcome the powerlessness that comes from being a victim and allows us to move forward and achieve more satisfying results in life. The benefits of finding the heart to own it. In Japan, you can see the own it attitude at work in the public transportation system. The Wall Street Journal reported, in the Tokyo area, millions of rail commuters can count on reaching their destination at pretty much the same minute every day. And that says as much about the Japanese as it does about their trains. It's the people that delay the trains, says Soji Yanagawa, a spokesman for Tokyo's Aiden Subway Company. But then again, it's people that keep the trains running on time. Tokyo's train system is so finely tuned that it has eliminated almost all sources of extended delay to the point where a major cause of lateness is the jumper or suicide. Tokyo elementary schools teach children the basics of train riding. In the stations, riders are bombarded with messages in school marmish voices. It's dangerous, so please don't run onto the trains. People who rush often get stuck in the closing doors, which delays departure. To keep strap hangers from cramming into doorways, the railways lash them with a bit of shame. We put extra workers on the platform, and mostly they stand there and look at the passengers, says Mr. Yanagawa. That usually works. Rigorous, maybe, but the commuters thronging the platform at Otemachi Station are eager adherents. That could only work in Japan, you might say. But the principle of ownership cuts across all cultures and companies. When everyone buys into the problem or situation and treats it as their own, results always improve. In another example, Josh Tanner traveled the fast track with his former blue chip company and had won accolades from the organization for his analytical prowess and political savvy. In 4 short years, he had learned how to get things done so well in a large bureaucratic organizational structure that most everyone applauded Josh as a high potential employee capable of making it to the top. Josh's reputation not only spread throughout the company, but also captured the attention of headhunters always on the lookout for talented people. It didn't take long for an executive recruiter to grab Josh's interest with an intriguing opportunity to work for a small startup company with enormous potential. Within a few weeks, Josh left the security of his large company job for a smaller, albeit riskier one, where he knew he could shine even more brightly than before. He relished working in a more entrepreneurial, fast-paced environment where he could really put his analytical and political skills to the test. In fact, he saw himself almost single-handedly turning the startup into a blue-chip company as the years flew by. Not long after Josh joined the new firm, however, he was hit with a landslide of feedback that threw him for a loop. Given his political savvy, Josh knew how to listen, but he just couldn't believe the feedback he was hearing. People at the new company weren't impressed with Josh's analytical bent and bureaucratic orientation. For several weeks, Josh denied the feedback, thinking to himself, "I've already accomplished so much in my career. I was a star in a blue-chip company. People here should feel lucky to get someone with my experience. I gave up a lot to come here." Eventually, Josh learned that he would not receive the promised promotion to vice president of marketing, and worse, if his performance did not improve, he would not be with the organization much longer. This turn of events dealt a shocking blow to Josh, who simply could not believe this was happening to him. "This is worse than a bad dream," he moaned. "It's my worst nightmare." Soon he began to mourn the loss of his fast-track career with his former company and lament the fact he had reached a dead end in his current situation. At this point, the company's management asked us to work with Josh. Immediately after contacting him, we began coaching him to move above the line. It wasn't easy, but Josh was at least willing to acknowledge the reality that he was no longer the star in his old company, but someone who needed to improve. Still, he continued feeling victimized by the new job and other people. He told us very convincingly one side of the story, moving through the victim cycle with ease and familiarity as he identified each level and anxiously explained how they had knocked him below the line. Finally, he explained what we recognized as a wait-and-see attitude. He was hoping that time would disprove his new associate's initial assessment of him. As we worked with Josh, it became clear that his greatest challenge lay in forging the link between his own behavior and the perceptions of his new associates. While he understood the perceptions, his unwillingness to accept their accuracy was rendering him unable to own it. At this point, we asked Josh to retell his story, this time focusing on the accountable facts of his circumstances instead of just the victim facts. Slowly, he began describing how people might have misinterpreted some of the things he had done after joining the company. But after each such admission, he would say something like, "But only an idiot would draw that kind of conclusion." As he continued to identify how his actions could have contributed to the perceptions of others, he gradually found it easier to recognize the things he did or did not do to contribute to his present predicament. As he did so, his anger began to abate. We explained to Josh that owning his circumstances did not mean accepting the perceptions of his new associates as total truth, but rather acknowledging a connection between his behavior and their perceptions. Finally, when we asked him the question, "What extra steps could you have taken?" Josh stopped to reflect on how he could have started off by asking people what kind of job they thought he was doing. Recognizing the differences between his new and old environments, and acknowledging that he had ignored the new culture's bias against excessive analysis and bureaucratic process, Josh finally admitted that he could have taken more care explaining to others the motives and principles behind his actions. As Josh's sense of accountability increased, so did his feelings of liberation. "I should have worked more closely with the people and the culture of the new company to obtain their ideas and involvement in the programs I was trying to implement. I could have been more open to their suggestions, and I should have involved myself more with their plans, purposes, and priorities. Wow, did I make a mistake by withdrawing into myself when the negative feedback started coming in?" Not until that moment did Josh fully address the other side of the story and own all the facts, particularly those that linked his behavior with his circumstances. He was not saying that he should shoulder 100% responsibility for everything that had happened, nor was he saying that the people in the new company had given him a 100% fair assessment. But he was finally admitting that he himself had done or failed to do certain things that contributed to his circumstances. "Man," he said during our final coaching session, "getting stuck below the line feels like being trapped in a room with no windows or doors. Now that the doors are open and I see the whole story, I can start changing my circumstances. Things can only get better." Josh came to own his circumstances when he made the connection between his behavior and the perceptions of his new associates. When he saw the reality that his past behavior had contributed to his present circumstances, he realized that his behavior from now on could create an entirely different and better future. This realization gave him the heart he needed to begin working to shift the perceptions of those with whom he worked, and before long, he lost all the distaste he had developed for his new associates. After a little more than 3 months of above-the-line behavior, Josh had so completely shifted the perceptions of his subordinates, peers, and boss that he won that promotion to vice president of marketing. The benefits of owning your circumstances more than compensate for the heart-wrenching effort involved. When you find the heart to own your circumstances, you automatically gain the commitment to overcome and change those circumstances for the better. The next phase of accountability. As this chapter shows, the Tin Woodsman from the Land of Oz symbolizes the second dimension of accountability, finding the heart to own your circumstances, and it further fuels Dorothy's realization that results come from within ourselves. In the next chapter, the Scarecrow will show you how to acquire the wisdom to solve it, and he will teach you how to put your see-it and own-it abilities to work in conjunction with a new solve-it attitude that can help you remove the obstacles on your path to results. Chapter 6, The Scarecrow, Obtaining the Wisdom to Solve It. "Who are you?" asked the Scarecrow when he had stretched himself and yawned, "and where are you going?" "My name is Dorothy," said the girl, "and I am going to the Emerald City to ask the Great Oz to send me back to Kansas." "Where is the Emerald City?" he inquired, "and who is Oz?" "Why, don't you know?" she returned in surprise. "No, indeed, I don't know anything. You see, I am stuffed, so I have no brains at all," he answered sadly. "Oh," said Dorothy, "I'm awfully sorry for you." Do you think, he asked, if I go to the Emerald City with you, that Oz would give me some brains? I cannot tell, she returned, but you may come with me if you like. If Oz will not give you any brains, you will be no worse off than you are now. The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. A few years ago, Toyota began to put its collective brain power to work solving a problem its competitors hadn't yet seen or owned. The world's second-largest automaker had been expanding capacity and building new plants despite an environment of serious global overcapacity, sluggish sales, and plant closings around the world. Using its head while others were losing theirs, the $100 billion company began rethinking everything. A Fortune magazine article told the story. Toyota is big, famously conservative, and hugely successful. Why mess with a good thing? In fact, the company that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology report, the machine that changed the world, called the most efficient automaker anywhere, is rethinking almost everything it does. Turning Japan's unnerving, stubborn economic slump into an opportunity, Toyota is reorganizing its operations, putting still more high technology into its factories, and reworking its legendary lean production system. Even if some of the measures fail, Toyota is likely to emerge an even more vigorous global competitor. Not overreacting to declining profits for a second year, the company continues hammering out solutions for the future. While some European and American automakers are closing plants, Toyota keeps opening new ones, increasing the company's total capacity to 1 million vehicles per year. The company would rather rely on cost-cutting to improve efficiency. As a prime example of a solvent company, Toyota is setting the pace for competitors. According to Fortune, just when the rest of the world started to catch on to Toyota's lean production system, Toyota is adapting it to accommodate new workers and advanced technology. A perpetual problem solver, Toyota thrives on challenges, always searching for ways to do things better and swiftly adapting to change. Donald N. Smith, a manufacturing expert at the University of Michigan's Engineering School and a longtime Toyota watcher, warns Toyota's competitors to assume that Toyota will constantly improve in the future. To think otherwise could court disaster. We agree. Toyota's undying and unwavering solve-it attitude will undoubtedly ensure its standout performance among global corporations for years to come. We must issue this warning, however. Solve-it means solving real problems, not tackling illusionary ones or just changing for change's sake. In another Fortune magazine article, reporters recount the saga of Ann Taylor Stores. Throughout the 1980s, Ann Taylor was the place for women to shop for stylish, well-made career clothes at better-than-department store prices. That strategy seemed sound until the 1990s, when Joseph Brooks, former head of Lord & Taylor and Merrill Lynch, bought the company from Campo Corporation for $430 million. As chief executive officer, Brooks began changing things for change's sake, substituting synthetics for silk, linen, and wool blends, and squeezing suppliers. One supplier, Irving Benson, president of Signy Design, bemoaned the situation to Fortune's reporters. "You get nothing for nothing. When Brooks told me he wanted to pay less to make a jacket, cuts had to come from either the fabric or how the garment was made." At the same time, Brooks expanded the operation from 139 to 200 stores. When customers did not materialize, the board forced Brooks to resign. The cost? Ann Taylor lost $15.8 million on sales of $438 million. To redirect the company's problem-solving efforts, the board picked Frame Cossacks, who had run Ann Taylor in the 1980s before she left to take over Talbot's, and then the Limited's Abercrombie and Fitch division. Frame Cossacks improved the company's private label fashions, increased sales monitoring, hired experts in specialty retailing, and developed lines of casual and weekend clothes. Within a few years, Ann Taylor had regained its former glory and profitability. It doesn't take a genius to solve the sort of problems Cossacks inherited. It just takes persistent functioning above the line, discovering real problems and designing appropriate solutions. Every organization wrestles from time to time with pesky problems that stand in the way of significant performance gains. The credit card division of one of the largest banks in the world utilized our services and implemented the Oz Principle Accountability Training Workshop in an effort to create greater accountability and ownership at every level of the organization, particularly at the front line. They focused in particular on the call center, where turnover had been exceptionally high and results in terms of handle time needed improvement. The call center handles a very high volume of calls from current and potential customers. This high volume of calls equates time to money. Every second of additional handle time equates to a $1 million drop in profit at the end of the year. With this thought planted firmly in mind, the leadership group in the call center determined that they would create accountability for reducing the average handle time by 50%, no small task since they had been struggling unsuccessfully to reduce handle time for years. Surprisingly, getting everyone to buy into this lofty objective wasn't as tough as management had anticipated. However, when it actually came down to figuring out how to bring about change, the going got a lot tougher. Still, as every member of the management team signed up and began looking for ways to improve performance, before long, they had changed the way they hired people, and they had implemented new software solutions. They also began measuring and reporting performance on a daily basis. Additionally, they implemented a balanced scorecard and focused their training to impact high-priority skills and behavior. The solve-it mentality flourished. Ideas poured in from everywhere as everyone from top management all the way to the front line took accountability for reducing the time needed to handle a call. The result? An increase of $143 million a year to the company's bottom line. Unfortunately, many people attempt to solve problems without seeing or owning reality, which makes the whole problem-solving effort nonsensical and misguided, as in the case of the U.S. Air Force's fight against ozone depletion. The Wall Street Journal's sarcastic article entitled, "Survivors Will Glow in Happiness Knowing the World is a Safer Place," provides an apt example. Fear not, the U.S. government will protect the ozone layer in the event of a nuclear holocaust. To do its bit to save the planet, the U.S. Air Force plans to retrofit its nuclear missiles with cooling systems that don't use chlorofluorocarbons. Those CFCs are blamed for depleting the atmosphere's ozone layer, which protects people from skin cancer, glaucoma, and other diseases by screening out harmful rays from the sun. Never mind that each intercontinental ballistic missile packs 3 to 10 bombs that can wipe out entire cities, making skin cancer and glaucoma moot concerns. Good PR, perhaps, but silly problem-solving. Simply acknowledging reality and accepting your role in creating your circumstances will achieve little if you fail to tackle real problems and remove true obstacles on your road to results. To do so, you must exercise wisdom. Attaining the third step above the line. Getting to the solve-it step quickly can often make all the difference in the world. Solving it can begin even before you fully take the step. Consider the CNN Money Report on the so-called underemployed people, or DUPPIES. Tough times have spawned a new class of depressed urban professionals. These folks were involved largely in the tech industry, where they went from high-paying jobs to low wages, swelling the ranks of the millions of underemployed people who long to do more but just can't find the work. Sadly, they have not only lost wages, they have lost the stimulation provided by more challenging and interesting jobs. As the article reports, according to government statistics, 4.8 million individuals are underemployed. That's on top of the 4.2 million non-working who don't bother. People who have been unemployed for some time rightfully take whatever work they can get, even if it means flipping burgers. Along with a smaller paycheck, they often talk of feelings of depression and discouragement, particularly as the time goes on and the ideal job doesn't materialize. While usually temporary, these periods of underemployment can become prolonged, and in either case, they force a fairly abrupt and major change in lifestyle. So what does solving it look like to the victim of a tough industry, an economic downturn, or a massive layoff that doesn't care who gets in the way? First, it begins with preparation, particularly if you work in a sector prone to swings in employment. Becoming professionally nimble and preparing yourself for the three-career life where an occasional job change is more the norm than the exception. It means keeping up on your technical skills with continuing education, networking with people outside of your industry, and making sure you've set aside a nest egg that will help smooth such a transition. The wisdom to solve it includes anticipating what could occur and preparing for the worst. When it does come, moving quickly to the solve-it step can make a huge difference. Janet Crystal, 51, says the loss of her job as a new products planner for companies like Lucent hasn't brought much of a shift in her lifestyle for several reasons. First, she was lucky enough to cash out stocks before the market crashed. Second, the Boston area resident has lived through layoffs before and was good about saving. Finally, Crystal says she learned long ago the satisfaction of living simply. She savors her garden, good books, and friendships. The solve-it attitude and behavior stems from continually asking the question, "What else can I do?" By constantly and rigorously asking this question, you avoid slipping back down into the victim cycle whenever certain events occur that would otherwise seem to block the road to results. Since solutions to thorny problems often do not readily reveal themselves, you must diligently search for them, but beware of wasting time below the line, because that will only dull your senses and discourage your imagination from discovering creative solutions. Remember, getting above the line is a process, not a singular event, and the road to results is strewn with hindrances and obstacles that can easily thrust even the most accountable person back below the line, particularly if he or she stops asking the central question, "What else can I do to rise above my circumstances and achieve the results I want?" In a Harvard Business Review article entitled "Empowerment or Else," author and company owner Robert Fry describes how he got his organization above the line to solve it. He recounts how bad the situation got after he and a partner purchased a small Cincinnati company. Founded in 1902, SynMade was a troubled company. It manufactured composite cans, sturdy paper containers with metal ends, and mailing tubes. Shortly after Fry's purchase, things began to spiral downward. Poorly negotiated labor contracts that have driven wages to an unsustainable level, a stagnant product line that had not changed in 20 years, and old plant equipment all conspired to drive profits from a meager 2% of sales to zero. Unless something happened quickly, the company would soon go under. It quickly became clear to Fry, the new president of SynMade, that renewed profitability depended on guiding the company out of the victim cycle, prompting people who had grown lethargic to act quickly and wisely to solve the firm's problems. As Ocelia Williams, then a sheet metal worker, later recalled, "When I first came to SynMade, the place was like a circus. There was a 10-minute break every hour, and people walked off the line at any time to go to the ladies' room or get a candy bar. People just did not see it or own it. They didn't understand their role in the company's situation or the need to revolutionize the way they did things." Fry and his partner immediately set out to make the necessary changes to move the organization above the line and solve the problems the company faced. After some difficult negotiations and concessions with the union, people finally began acknowledging the company's dire circumstances. They especially appreciated that executives like Fry were beginning, for the first time, to share previously guarded information on the company's performance. Although Fry was making steady progress moving the organization above the line, he still struggled to get employees to own it and solve it. Only they, after all, could lift the company out of the quagmire. As Fry recalls, "I wanted the workers to worry. Did any one of them ever spend a moment on a weekend wondering how the company was doing, asking themselves if they'd made the right decisions the week before? Maybe I was unrealistic, but I wanted that level of involvement." He continued, "After a bad start, I had begun to see that the workers knew more about the company and its operation than I or the new managers I'd hired. They were better qualified to plan production for the next day, the coming week, the month ahead. They had more immediate knowledge of materials, workload, and production problems. They were ideally placed to control costs and cut waste. But how could I give them some reason to care?" As the organization gradually moved above the line, people began to change the way they viewed their roles, especially in terms of responsibility and accountability. It wasn't easy, as Fry himself admits. Change of any kind is a struggle with fear, anger, and uncertainty, a war against old habits, hidebound thinking, and entrenched interests. No company can change any faster than it can change the hearts and minds of its people. To help capture their hearts and minds, to get them spontaneously to act in the solve-it mode, Fry implemented an innovative profit-sharing plan, establishing a pattern of cause and effect that would link what people did with what people got. After realizing that his managers habitually resorted to a command-and-control, tell-them-what-to-do approach to the job, He found that the workers had grown complacent with it, too. My managers believed that managers should manage and that hourly workers should do what they were told. The trouble was, most of the workers were perfectly happy with that arrangement. They wanted generous wages and benefits, of course, but they did not want to take responsibility for anything more than doing their own jobs the way they had always done them. Such behavior, he knew, kept people from doing anything more than just complaining about the company's problems. After all, why try to fix something you don't own? He also knew that such a culture of complaint would eventually destroy Sinmaid. Fry continues, "It was bad enough forcing them to use new equipment, but I was also forcing them to change job descriptions, to change work habits, to think differently about themselves and the company. What my employees were telling me, both in deeds and in words, was, 'We don't want to change, and we're much too old to change. Anyway, we don't come to work to think.'" Celia Williams recalls how the union president actually argued that it was non-union for employees to take on so much responsibility. "That bothered me," says Williams. "I kept asking myself if I was truly union, but I couldn't see how we were going to protect ourselves and keep our jobs if the company went under. And I couldn't see how the company could work unless we all took our share of the responsibility." A lot of people thought those ideas were off the wall. Fry further observes, "But which of us is ever eager to take on new responsibilities?" Recalling how his people reacted, he says, "They never dreamed how much responsibility I wanted to lay on their shoulders, but they disliked what little they had seen so far." Coaching people into the solve-it mode took patience. Fry states, "I made people meet with me. Then instead of telling them what to do, I asked them. They resisted. 'How can we cut the waste on this run?' I'd say. Or, 'How are we going to allocate the overtime on this order?' 'That's not my job,' they'd say. 'Why not?' I'd say. 'Well, it just isn't,' they'd say. 'How in the world can we have a participative management if you won't participate?' 'I don't know,' they'd say. 'Because that's not my job either. That's your job.' And I'd lose my temper. In the beginning, I really did lose my temper every time I heard the words, 'It's not my job.'" With persistent effort to overcome that lethargy and convince people that solving it is not an extra activity but part of the job, Fry finally started to see results. He recalls, "Gradually, hourly workers in general began to take on some of the work of problem-solving and cost control. I pushed and prodded and required people to help solve problems related to their own jobs. Sometimes I felt like a fool, albeit a very pleased fool, when they came up with simple solutions to problems that had persistently stumped me and my managers." Having moved the organization above the line and taken the solve-it step, Sinmaid now finds itself well on the way to prosperity. It enjoys a highly differentiated product line that Fry observes is doing well in a demanding market and making a lot of money. One-time customer delivery has risen to 98%. Absenteeism has practically vanished. Full-time employees now monitor temporary workers in an effort to reduce waste. Productivity has improved 30%. Grievances have declined. Strict adherence to job descriptions is a thing of the past, and people are making more money than other workers in comparable industries. As the Sinmaid story illustrates, solving it requires an ongoing commitment to ask the question, "What else can I do?" Moving above the line and adopting the solve-it attitude can do more than almost anything else to help fledgling or struggling companies become robust and thriving enterprises. Nestle Purina illustrates the point nicely. The company had planned to introduce an easy-to-open Alpo dog food can by April 2003, but highly successful preliminary market tests convinced the marketing department to accelerate the new product's launch. Using concepts and principles from our Oz Principle accountability training, such as continually asking what else can we do to get the results we want, the Alpo Easy Open Can team got to work, coordinating the activities at three plant locations, Weirton, West Virginia, Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Crete, Nebraska. The Easy Open team assembled people across several functions to accomplish the impossible, cutting market introduction by more than a year. For their extraordinary efforts, the Alpo Easy Open Can team received the company's prestigious Pillars of Excellence Award. Marketing manager Kristen Pontius expressed her elation with the results in a recognition letter that went out to everyone involved. "I wanted to write a quick note of congratulations to the Alpo Easy Open Can team. On Tuesday of this week, this team was awarded the prestigious Nestle Purina Pet Care Company, NPPC, Pillars of Excellence Award by CEO Pat McGinnis. This award is very well deserved. You worked at an incredible rate with great dedication to accomplish your goal. Easy Open Cans began shipping 1 year and 1 week prior to original plans. Not only did you meet your goal, you exceeded it, as Easy O cans shipped even 3 weeks earlier than expected. You did all of this while facing multiple obstacles, including needing to design special lids, having to hand orient cans until equipment arrived, and needing to fill an overwhelming volume push while maintaining quality and integrating everything into the NPPC supply system. All goals were met, and many beaten, through the hard work of a team that wouldn't fail to overcome all the obstacles. The Allentown, Crete, and Weirton factory teams did it in a way that set a powerful example for the rest of the company. Their answer to what else can I do? The seemingly impossible. Remember Mike Eagle? As president of IVAC Corporation, a mid-sized medical instruments company, he also helped his senior team and people throughout the company take the solve it step and stay above the line. The company developed a new Model 570 set of instruments, composed of 70 different pieces of equipment, and promised Sparrow Hospital in Lansing, Michigan, one of IVAC's first customers for the new product, delivery before Christmas. One day, late in the year, Mike learned that the delivery could not take place as promised because the new Model 570 instruments required last-minute changes in their printed circuit boards. Determined to keep IVAC's commitment and to solve this problem, he asked what else IVAC people could do to hit the target date. After intense discussion, a possible solution emerged. Could a concerted effort from an ad hoc project team close the gap? Some said maybe. Mike said yes. Immediately, he assembled the new team with representatives from product development, instrument operations, engineering, quality assurance, and shipping, urging them to invest every brain cell in effecting the circuit board changes within a week. Just 1 week later, the Model 570 instruments were ready for shipping. But then a new obstacle arose. Due to heavy holiday orders, all commercial shipping services were already overbooked. Once again, Mike asked, "What else can we do?" And the answer came, "There is nothing else we can do short of renting a Learjet to get this product there on time." Mike didn't miss a beat. So we rent a Learjet. Astonished at Mike's get-it-done attitude, the team enthusiastically went to work. The shipping department raced to rent a Learjet and reconfigure its interior to accommodate the Model 570. Then, at the last minute, it turned out that the company had miscalculated the size of the order. Even with the reconfigured jet interior, all the boxes simply would not fit. Unwilling to accept defeat so close to the goal line, freight packers opened each box and repacked all 70 different instruments. Finally, at 3 p.m. on December 17, the Learjet left the San Diego airport for Lansing, Michigan. In anticipation of any further problems and intent upon doing whatever else it took to get the result, a product manager from IVAC accompanied the flight. A few hours later, the jet arrived in Wichita, Kansas for refueling. While taxiing down the runway to take off again, the pilot detected a broken altimeter. Able to fly but a short distance at low altitude, the pilot took the aircraft 200 miles to Lincoln, Nebraska, where the product manager got on the telephone with the company's traffic coordination department to track down the faulty altimeter part, a task quite out of the ordinary for this department. After 5 hours of intense communications with airlines and manufacturers, the part was secured, flown to the airport, and installed in the jet. At 3:30 a.m. on December 18th, the shipment left Lincoln for Lansing, where it arrived at 5:45 a.m. Meanwhile, IVAC's in-service and training personnel, who were scheduled to instruct the people at Sparrow Hospital in the use of the new Model 570 instruments, had gotten stuck in a snowstorm in Chicago and had traveled all night by car to arrive at the hospital on time the next morning. At 7:30 a.m. the following day, IVAC unveiled the Model 570 instruments at Sparrow Hospital on time, as expected, and commenced with its service and training operations. Unlike the people at IVAC, Sinmade, and Nestle Purina, many in other organizations do not ask the question, what else can we do to rise above our circumstances and achieve the results we desire? That, as much as anything else, explains why so many of their problems go unsolved. Why people fail to solve it. As people begin solving problems, they almost always encounter obstacles, both expected and unexpected, that can cause them to sink below the line into the victim cycle. To avoid this, people must fully commit themselves to stay above the line during problem solving, particularly when an unanticipated crisis attacks. One of our clients has demonstrated an uncanny ability to cope with and beat the often powerful temptation to fall below the line. Again, to protect the privacy of this organization and the individuals involved, we have disguised the circumstances and details of the story, but we assure you it's otherwise true. Joe McGann, the store operations vice president for a mid-sized department store chain, had experienced a trying year in which retail sales declined alarmingly. Without any new merchandising or marketing programs over the last 3 years, Joe and his 84 store managers felt as if they were fighting a battle without any bullets. However, as some people in the company began to recognize and own the circumstances, new life and hope spread throughout the organization, and along with it, a new merchandising campaign that breathed fresh optimism and a can-do attitude into the store managers. Even the sales clerks applauded. However, even as sales increased and morale climbed higher, the company still needed to do a lot more just to catch up with their more successful competitors. Yes, the department store chain was making progress, and thankfully people were attempting to stay above the line with a strong problem-solving attitude, but it wasn't easy, particularly for the store managers who fought in the trenches for retail sales each and every day. Late one night, in a hotel at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, Joe met for a brief meeting with his 5 regional managers, each one of whom supervised 15 to 18 stores. All 6 of them were flying somewhere else and had arranged a quick stopover for this unusual meeting. As they gathered in a small conference room, each person wanted to appear accountable, willing to own their circumstances, and committed to operating above the line. But all of them were strained by the high expectations of senior management for continued improvements in performance. Their strain was intensified by the diminishing effect of the latest merchandising program and the delay of promised incentive compensation plans. Before the meeting officially started, one of the regional managers asked somewhat hesitantly, "Before we begin, can we drop below the line for just a few minutes? We need to talk about what's going on." Everyone laughed, but then unleashed a lot of pent-up anxieties, airing their thoughts about what was going wrong in the company, who deserved the blame, and why the situation was terribly unfair. After about 15 minutes, Joe waved his hand. "Okay, now that we've gotten that off our chests, let's get back above the line so we can determine what else we can do to achieve the results we want." Having aired their frustrations, the regional managers could finally engage in a productive discussion of what they could do to solve the problems and remove the obstacles that confronted them. While they all knew that remaining below the line would get them nowhere, they had consciously dropped into the victim cycle for a brief moment to vent their frustrations and recite their discouragement with their current circumstances. Without their increased awareness of the fruitlessness of remaining below the line, Joe and his team may have unwittingly prevented themselves from rising above the line to solve their problems. Without such awareness, it's awfully easy to succumb to the urge to stay below the line. The trick is to go there only briefly and be committed to get out of there quickly. When people give up asking the solve-it question, as Joe McCann and his team felt tempted to do, they drop back below the line into the victim cycle, where they will never find the creative solutions they need to fashion a better future. In a Fortune magazine article by Brian Dumain, "Leaving the Rat Race Early," the author cites a Roper survey